Hello and welcome, Transformation Talk Radio listeners and podcast listeners everywhere. My name is Ellen Stewart, and I am the pushy broad from the Bronx.
She's the pushy broad from the Bronx, New York. Follow her voice, her straight talk is nice. She's the pushy broad from the Bronx, oh yeah. Don't be surprised if you wanna listen twice. Make decisions, find the right choice. Know yourself better, find your own voice. It's okay if you need help today, cause everybody needs a little push. From the pushy broad from the Bronx, New York.
This weekly show, Everybody Needs a Little Push, with Ellen Stewart, the pushy broad from the Bronx, will be aired every Wednesdays on Transformation Talk Radio and podcast stations everywhere at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern. I am delighted to bring you my weekly podcast program, which I hope will inspire you, coach you,
sometimes make you laugh,
and give you the push moment you need to move forward. And I'm going to do it the pushy Broadway. Straight up. No BS, easy, quick, with answers, suggestions, and directions that will give you a coaching experience that will be part cheerleader and part drill sergeant. Because everybody needs a little push from time to time. And here comes yours.
Everybody, 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 everybody needs a little push.
Everybody needs a little push.
There's a wonderful article on self-development written by Psych Alive. I'd like to share it with you. They start by quoting Aristotle. Knowing yourself is the beginning of all wisdom. The greatest and most important adventure of our lives is discovering who we really are. Yet so many of us walk around either not really knowing or listening to an awful inner critic that gives us all the wrong ideas about ourselves. We mistakenly think of self-understanding as self-indulgence, and we carry on without asking the most important question we'll ever ask. Who am I really? As Mary Oliver puts it, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Finding yourself may sound like an inherently self-centered goal, but it is actually an unselfish process that is at the root of everything we do in life. In order to be the most valuable person to the world around us, the best partner, parent, etc., we have to first know who we are, what we value, and in effect, what we have to offer. This personal journey is one every individual will benefit from taking. It is a process that involves breaking down, shedding layers that do not serve us in our lives and don't reflect who we really are. Yet it also involves a tremendous act of building up, recognizing who we are and who we want to be, and passionately going about fulfilling our unique destiny, whatever that may be. It's a matter of recognizing our personal power, yet being open and vulnerable to our experiences. It isn't something to fear or avoid, berating ourselves along the way, but rather something to seek out with curiosity and compassion, the same that we would have towards a fascinating new friend. These are the words of Psych Alive. And with this in mind, I'd like to introduce you to a very special guest. I'd like to tell you about Tom Gentry. Tom is a writer and an internationally certified addiction counselor who lives in West Palm Beach, Florida. He has spent more than 20 years helping people and families heal from wounds of addiction and the related issues.
He facilitates groups, focuses on relationships and codependency issues, and the transition into manhood. Tom found recovery himself as a young adult, and he's grateful to be breaking the cycle of dysfunction in his family, from which it has struggled for many generations. Currently, Tom is a writer, and he produces and hosts The Path to Authenticity, a podcast about being true to oneself. He says it builds from the premise that when a person owns their identity, the world benefits.
So I thought, since the podcast is really gaining lots of traction and it's really moving in the right direction,
then this is the time to ask Tom Gentry about his own path to authenticity and have him share it today with our listeners and our viewers. The Pushy Broad from the Bronx is delighted to welcome Tom Gentry. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hi, Ellen. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure to have you here. So, The Path to Authenticity. Tell us a little bit about where it's airing and just a little bit about what it's about.
Well, first I'd like to say, if you don't know Ellen, I've known Ellen for quite some time, and I can tell you for certain that she is definitely the pushy broad from the Bronx.
And we think that's a good thing, right, Tom?
Absolutely. It's a great thing. So, The Path to Authenticity, you know, I always wanted to be on the radio, even as a little kid. And my path in life led me away from that relatively early on. And it has finally meandered back over the last year or so.
I did radio in college and then did radio in my young adulthood. And I really enjoy that medium. I really do. And of course, today for us, podcasts give us a platform to return to that in a very big way. And being on Transformation Talk Radio, I'm also able to get that out into a different platform as well. Mm-hmm. But the meaning of the path to authenticity, being one's own true self, has to start from your roots, I would assume. So let's talk about your beginnings. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in a Catholic neighborhood in central Indiana. I'm the youngest of eight kids.
Wow.
So I have five older sisters and two older brothers. I learned pretty early on that I wanted the favor of the people around me. I wanted the people who loved me to look upon me favorably. And I learned how to kind of, you know, when you're the little brother of eight kids and your nearest sibling is 6 years older than you, your mom already has seven other kids to take care of. So it's like all of a sudden they got a part-time job and I'm it. So I grew up acutely aware of that. I sort of went out of my way to not be a problem or a burden on anyone else. So it's like if I was a light, I learned to dim myself very early on.
So you learned to fade into the background. About how old were you when you came to this conclusion?
Probably early elementary school. Maybe 7 or 8, yeah. I remember part of my story is that, you know, being the youngest of eight, my parents were a lot older than the parents of my peers. And I remember at one point taking my parents to the chili supper in elementary school. And the next day, the other kids to me saying, "Why did you bring your grandma and grandpa?" And, you know, as a little kid, you want to be like everybody else. You don't want to feel different than everyone else. And that kind of stung. And I remember going home and talking to one of my siblings about it, you know, kind of trying to understand how should I feel about this? This is what happened. And the message I got was, well, no matter how old they are, they're good parents and you shouldn't feel. That was the message I got. You shouldn't feel. So I think that was a key part of me beginning to learn to sort of suppress my inner voice and not listen to myself, sort of impose the standards of the people around me onto myself and try to sort of acquiesce and fit into that environment, rather than, you know, really shine my light.
Well, not making waves. As you said, your reference to dimming that light early on, trying not to be a burden, and at the same time, trying to find a path towards becoming an individual and craving the attention that you needed, of course. Mm-hmm. So being starved for attention, what did you find yourself doing?
Well, you know, my first real love was baseball. I excelled in Little League baseball. And I had the kind of parents who were going to let me have my own experience. They weren't, you know, my dad was never the dad who was going to get overly involved and try to push me into doing anything any certain way. So it was my own. It was my very own experience, and I was good at it. And it was a place for me to belong where I could completely be myself. It didn't have anything to do with my siblings or so that I needed somewhere to belong, and that was somewhere I belonged. And so the love for that was really deep. And for a long time, I wanted to make that my life. And I had an experience. My parents were great about teaching me, if you work hard, you can do anything you want with your life, you know, practice, all that stuff. So I really took that on. And I was the kid who in fifth, sixth grade was after baseball practice, then running or then practicing on my own and, you know, off season. I mean, I really was obsessive about it as a kid and was determined to be a Major League Baseball player. And I had a middle school math teacher who showed a lot of favoritism and really didn't make us do anything. We just talked in his class, and he'd give us straight A's if he liked you. And we were having a conversation one day about what we wanted to be when we grew up. And this teacher said, I told him, you know, I'm going to be a Major League Baseball player. And he said, I don't know. I said, no, I'm telling you, like, I'm going to be. And he said, Tom, it's one in a million. And I said, well, I'm going to be that one in a million. And he said, nah. And, you know, this guy had never seen me play, and he was probably right, but I don't feel like it was really his place to tell me that. And I didn't quit immediately, but eventually I quit. I let that message permeate me, and I ran with it, whether I wanted to or not.
It's very interesting because you mentioned that your parents really did give you some very solid foundation in terms of teaching. They taught you to think for yourself, right? Yes. You said dad did not micromanage you. So you were able to be an independent thinker. You were able to take risks. You were able to try something new. And you mentioned that mom and dad said that with at least gave you the message that through hard work, you can accomplish anything.
Right.
So here were your parents who were pretty integral in your life telling you these very strong parental guidelines. And yet one teacher one time was able to sway you in a different direction. Why do you think that was?
I looked up to him.
And you didn't look up to mom and dad?
I did. But, you know, with mom and dad, I had great parents. There were a lot of very supportive messages like that. But I can also say when the rubber hit the road with the things I wanted to do with my life, they also projected their fear onto me. I don't know if you can make a living that way. Maybe you should do this instead. So I later got that kind of message from them. It was sort of a mixed bag. Overall, it was good. But I got some mixed messages from my parents too. I did.
So here you are, a very impressionable child. So you're still in grade school, I would gather, right?
Well, that was middle school when that happened.
Was middle school, okay. Mm-hmm. Middle school. And so now your dreams of becoming a Major League Baseball player are dashed. What happens next in the Tom Gentry saga?
Well, in the Tom Gentry saga, I played baseball through my sophomore year in high school. And about the time I stopped playing baseball was when my drinking really began to take off.
Tell us about that. Where did your drinking start? How old were you?
Well, I grew up in a home with a lot of drinking and alcoholism on both sides of the family. Lots of heavy drinking. You know, my dad always had a refrigerator full of beer, and the way I would describe his liquor cabinet is it contained anything some passerby might require for any bartending concoction they could think of. He had it always. And he, you know, he came of age in that Mad Men era when people came home and had a cocktail. And so it became pretty apparent to me at a young age that the guys in my family, that's what they did for fun. That's how they bonded with each other. That's how they connected with each other. And I wanted to be a part of that at a very young age. I honestly don't know how young I was the first time I drank. I remember the first time I was drunk was about sixth grade. I think it was the summer after sixth grade. And, you know, it was the kind of thing where when my parents weren't around, I'd get into the booze. I had an uncle who owned a bar. So there was always, it was always have kegs at their home. Like they just always have kegs. Not like for a party, like all the time, a refrigerator where they always keep a keg. And my dad, I remember he did that one year. And the way my mom kids about it is the deal was he was going to get a keg to have over the holidays. And by the time 4th of July rolled around, she felt like we've been through enough holidays now. You should probably get rid of it. But that whole time, you know, on Saturday morning when my mom and dad would go grocery shopping, I'd be tapping the keg as a 12, 13-year-old kid.
You said you were drinking through high school. Was there a time that you got into trouble, that your drinking got you into serious trouble as a kid?
Not really. I mean, there were a couple times. I mean, I was really a good kid. I didn't get into much trouble at all. But one major turning point with my drinking was, you know, I made up my mind I was going to not go away to college. I was going to work my way through school. I was going to take a year off and work full time and eventually go to college part time while I lived with my mom and dad. And so I got a full time job after high school in construction. And it didn't take long for reality to set in that, you know, this really isn't all that great. This really isn't what I want for myself, but I felt stuck. And that's about the time that I remember intentionally drinking to change the way I felt, because I was so depressed. And that was a real turning point for me. Before, it was fun and social and, you know, I had a little bit of a identity from it because I could drink and all that. But when I started to do it to intentionally alter my consciousness, it was a problem.
So what you're saying is by drinking, you were able to lift your spirits. Most people think, or many, many alcoholics and addicts that I talked to that picked up a drink or a drug did that to escape. Were you escaping from the sadness and the depression? Would that be accurate?
Yes. Specifically, what was happening is that I'm in such misery that I want to just quiet it and be able to sleep. And so I'm going to do a few shots and crash.
So that was happening in high school.
That was 19 the first time that happened.
19. And how long did that go on, Tom?
Well, I got sober when I was 23. I remember being very much afraid to turn 21 because I knew I would have unfettered access to alcohol, and that wasn't going to be good.
So you already were very much aware of the fact that this was a serious issue, and you were trying to protect yourself from yourself, basically.
Deep down. Yeah, I don't know that I really recognize that on the surface, but deep down, I was afraid.
And then, of course, there must have been some kind of turning point for you. You must have realized that this wasn't working for you. What point was that initially?
Well, it certainly wasn't that I woke up one morning and thought, I'm going to go live a better life.
No, I'm sure not.
You know, one of the key things that happened, you know, I told you there was alcoholism all through my family. And one of my older sisters was a chronic alcoholic. And she lived here in South Florida and had liver problems. And a doctor had referred her to treatment in 1995. I had, you know, I drank with her. I mean, she was, at that point, she was about 40. So she was close to 20 years older than me. But she got sober and she saw her little brother spiraling down. And so she started reaching out to me. The key message that she conveyed to me is that you can be much, much happier if you're sober. You have no idea how great it can be. And I heard her, and I also, knowing what kind of drinker she was, that it really made an impression on me that this place she went and what she was doing with her life now, it must be powerful, because if she's not drinking, wow, you know? So, you know, there were a few things that happened, but there were a couple arrests for public intoxication. But long story short, I was living with my mom and dad, and I was working full-time installing hardwood floors, traveling, you know, doing it in retail stores. And so when we would run out of material, we would go home and wait, you know, so I'd be not really laid off, but just waiting for work for periods of time. And I just drank the whole entire time I wasn't working. And it, you know, long story short, I nearly drank myself to death. And, you know, another key element to all this, a real turning point, was, you know, one of my other sisters kept trying to get me to come too on this last day of my drinking. And of course I just wanted her to leave me alone and let me keep drinking. So I'd play possum or whatever. And they had called an ambulance like 3 or 4 different times that day, and I kept refusing their care. And finally, the last time the ambulance came, I got in and I went to the emergency room. Mm-hmm. Blew a 3.9 an hour after my last drink.
Oh my God.
So, you know, rewind back to elementary school. I remember being in this teacher's class and her going around the room one day asking us all what we wanted to be when we grew up. And here was this bold little girl, Angie Lee, who raised her hand and said, "I'm going to be a doc." And so Angie Lee and I went all through high school together. We were in gifted classes together. And at 23 years old, stinking of whiskey on a gurney in an emergency room, in walks Angie Lee, who's doing her residency, and looks down at me and says, "Tom, what are you doing with your life?" And it was, you know, like God himself appeared in the room. I mean, and I'll never forget it. She showed me so much love, which I needed desperately at the time, but it made an impression on me. It opened my eyes. First of all, like, this is where you could have been in your life if you'd have made different choices. But also, there are good people out there who see your value and know that you're better than this.
And they also become power of examples for us to strive towards. I mean, basically it's what we call one of your epiphany moments.
Right.
So there you are. And then you obviously recovered in the hospital and you moved on to some kind of treatment. Tell us a little bit about what that was about.
Well, what happened is that I refused to stay in that hospital nonetheless. Mm. So it was very hot. And obviously I told you my blood alcohol content was extremely high. And they told my parents, don't take him home. He could go into a coma and die. And so long story short, I refused to stay. And my dad called the police and they arrested me for public intoxication.
Wow.
They took me to jail. I spent the night in jail, and I'm not really the jail type. I'm not a guy who can, like, no matter how intoxicated I may be, I'm not going to sleep in jail. So I sat there all night and thought about where my life was going. And, you know, this day before, I had been talking to someone at a treatment facility here in Florida. And at the hospital, they wanted me to stay there at a program there. And I refused it, kept saying, "No, I want to go to Florida." And by the time 7 a.m. the next morning rolled around and I got my phone call, I called my dad and said, "Listen, I don't care where I go. I just need help." And so by 2 o'clock that afternoon, I was on a flight to West Palm Beach. So my sister picked me up at the airport. My mom flew with me to make sure I got here. And I got into treatment around midnight, and you know, I've really never looked back. One of my sisters dropped me off at the airport that day before and said, you know, just go there and do what the people say and get better. And that's what I did.
How long were you in treatment?
I was in treatment for about 30 days and then was referred to a transitional living facility or halfway house. And I lived there for 9 months as a client, then became the resident manager for another 7 months. So for about 15 months, I was under someone else's care.
And you have been clean and sober ever since?
I have.
So how long are you in recovery?
Half my life, 23 years now. I've been sober as long as I was alive before I got sober, which just blows my mind to even think about.
Well, congratulations. And considering you did get clean and sober in West Palm and now you reside there, I guess it's really working for you.
We'll be right back. Are you ready to put down that drink or drug for good? Are you struggling to maintain your recovery from addictive behaviors? Do you need help with a family member or loved one who's in early recovery or battling addiction? Get the help and guidance you need by arranging a recovery recharged phone session with me, Ellen Stewart, Pushy Broad from the Bronx, certified life and recovery coach. Call 1-800-889-1757. Make an appointment today. Or go to my website, pushybroadfromthebronx.com, and click on the link that says Recovery Recharged. Don't wait. Get the help you need today. This is Ellen Stewart, Pushy Broad from the Bronx, on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
So moving on from your beginnings and from the time that you obviously hit bottom and you've moved forward from active addiction or active alcoholism into recovery, talk to us about how treatment and the work that you do constantly reinforces your own recovery and also pays that forward to others.
I think one of the key lessons I learned very early on is that, you know, there's no arriving, there's no graduation or anything. The people who actually do well at this continue to grow, continue to work on themselves. And you know, one thing I would like to go back to that happened day one in treatment, there were things I was doing in my life that I wasn't telling anyone about, that I was ashamed of. I knew that I needed to get real. When I got the treatment, you know, one of the first things that happens in this particular treatment facility is that the new people tell their story to their peers. I was really afraid to let people know that one of the things I did at the end of my drinking out of pure desperation, you know, we get into this craziness of alcoholism and we try to control our drinking and do all these crazy things. Well, I kept thinking, well, if I don't buy alcohol, then I won't drink. And then, you know, I can't sleep at night and I have all this anxiety. And the next thing you know, my dad always kept a half gallon of Listerine under the bathroom sink. And eventually I drank it. And it wasn't just once. It was something I did for a while. And I actually had myself convinced while I was doing that, that I wasn't really drinking. So I had a lot of shame about that. I mean, that is not a cool thing to tell people. But I knew if I wasn't honest that this whole thing wouldn't work. So that day one, scared to death, I pushed myself to tell those guys that I drank Listerine.
And after that happened, how was it received?
Completely opposite from the way that I thought it would be. I thought they would shun me, expected embarrassment and shame. And what I got was love and acceptance. And I connected with them because I was real and authentic. And I was shown love and favor because I was real and authentic. Where through the rest of my life, up to that point, I was kind of faking it. You know, I wasn't really telling people what I wanted, what I was doing. I was telling them half of what was going on in my life. I wasn't being real with anybody. I was afraid to. I was afraid I'd be rejected. So then in this new way of life, as I'm beginning it, I can't imagine a worse story to tell a bunch of strangers. And what do I get? Love. And it totally set the tone for my treatment experience, first of all. But I learned a really powerful lesson, and that's that when we're real with people, we're accepted. That's what people want from us. That's how we connect.
So let's reiterate that as a message to all alcoholics and addicts out there that are thinking about going into treatment. What can you say to them that will help them through this with the kinds of experience you've just conveyed?
Well, don't hold anything back. We all have stories we're afraid to tell. We all, whether we're people with addiction issues or not, we all have stories we're afraid to tell. And what connection is about is being real with other people. Now, we don't want to be real with everybody. I mean, we want to be choosy about who we tell. But if you're going to bother to go to addiction treatment, then those are the right people to tell. They're bound by law to keep confidentiality. It's inherently safe to do it there. And don't leave anything out. That's a surefire way to fail, to intentionally leave things out.
I think it becomes a twofold thing, certainly also being in recovery myself. As you said, it's not only being able to admit the things that we have done because it's difficult for us to hold on to our secrets and being afraid of what other people will think. So part of it is having the courage to admit your deepest, darkest secrets and the things that make you most ashamed. And the other part of it is realizing that the people around you are coming from a position of not judging those secrets, right, simply because either they're legally bound not to judge those secrets, but many of them are also in recovery as well. So the best thing about the rooms, the 12-step rooms or the recovery rooms, wherever you choose to go, or recovery in itself, is that we are talking to people that understand what we are going through, which means in recovery, we learn not to judge. So that's the second part of it. So it's a constant reinforcement. Stop judging yourself so that you don't judge others, and the cycle continues. So it's a twofold lesson for all of us. Would you not say that was the case?
I mean, there are so many lessons in that for me. Another one is that, you know, one of my favorite quotes is Mark Twain said that courage isn't the absence of fear. It's the resistance to fear. It's the mastery of fear. And I was scared and I walked through the fear. And that was, that's the first time I really remember doing it in that profound a way, but I've done it many, many times since. It's a muscle as people in recovery that we need to learn to develop if we plan on staying clean and sober, to walk through fear. Often, it's the message that our body and our system gives us to know that we're on the right track, doing the right thing. The right thing a lot of times is the hardest thing to do.
It really is the hardest thing to do. I talk on different podcasts about having a relationship with the fear, kind of walking hand in hand with it and taking it with us, because we're not going to dispel that anytime soon. It's not going to disappear. We have to learn to have a relationship with it, and also to understand that, at least in this program, we're met with people that have a true understanding. So they're making it more comfortable for us to let out our fears in a way that we can cope. So that's a good thing. Let's go on and talk a little bit more about your true self and what led up to the path to authenticity. Let's talk about that.
Well, I think one thing I'd like to touch on is that, you know, the longer I'm sober, the more I learned that what I really wanted was connection always. That's what, you know, I wanted to drink with the guys in my life because that's what they did, because I wanted to connect with them. And then when I became social as a young adult, you know, it also served that purpose, but I never quite got it the way I wanted to until I got sober. And then when I began becoming real and being authentic with the other people around me and really showing up as Tom and not Tom pretending to be someone else, I have been able to connect in the way that I always wanted to before. but in sobriety.
So give us an idea of exactly who Tom is. What are some of Tom's characteristics?
Well, I'm a dad. That's a pretty significant part of my identity. I have a 14-year-old son, and it's always been very important to me to be a good dad. And I always wanted to be a dad. I even knew that in very early recovery that that was going to be important to me. But, you know, in terms of my life purpose, one of the key elements of it for me is I have come to understand, accept that one of my key purposes in life is to break the cycle of hurt in my family, of alcoholism, of dysfunction, of intergenerational trauma. You know, it's my job to be a catalyst of change. That's how I make sense of what all this is that has happened to me in my life. That's how it adds up to me that this is the person who I am. For me, at a pretty young age, I knew I wanted to help people. I wasn't sure what that would look like, but what recovery has enabled me to do is to use the gifts that I have in a synergistic way to help other people. You know, I have some journalism and writing experience, so I've been able to use that. I've been able to use my experience in recovery and my training in the addiction treatment industry and my experiences with my family to be able to show up for people in ways that not everybody can. Not everybody knows what it's like to be a young adult male alcoholic who's suffered emotional abuse at the hands of an older sibling, or, you know, I do. So when I see that kid whose brother has torn him down his whole life and he's completely dejected, he doesn't believe in himself, all these negative messages he got from the people around him, he has now internalized and he's saying these negative things to himself all the time. I can look at him and say, I know what it feels like to look up to your older brother and still want to bash his brains in with a baseball bat. And nothing's wrong with you for feeling that way. It makes total sense that you would, because that's the other thing we do with our emotions is we beat ourselves up for feeling these things when we judge ourselves for having a lot of feelings to which we attach a negative value, like anger and frustration and sadness. We beat ourselves up for these things.
So in our path to authenticity, no matter who we are, would it be safe to say that it comes from the awareness and the learning experiences that we share, to be aware of the lessons that we've taken with us, and not only that, but to absorb them? We can understand what has happened in our past, and you have said that you've gone through a childhood that is certainly trying at times, and you've overcome it, and you have overcome the active addiction, but now learning more about who you are and where your passions are and learning to stay in recovery is part of what makes it so authentic. If you didn't learn these lessons and you were continuously doomed to repeat them, the path to authenticity would not be as clear as it is now. Right? One doesn't know who their true selves are unless they're willing to explore what that is, unless they're willing to be aware of the lessons that they've learned along the way.
Well, my experience is these things, you know, I had to be willing to delve into them. And it's been easier to do that in some areas of my life than others. You know, it's been a little harder for me to do it in romantic relationships. It took me longer to learn the lessons I needed to learn in that area of my life. But as long as we avoid these lessons, you know, they keep happening. So we're doomed to keep doing the same thing. But on the flip side of that, when we're willing to embrace the lessons and see that they are lessons, they become strengths. Sometimes I almost think of my alcoholism. I always loved the Incredible Hulk as a kid, you know, his superpower was his anger, which, you know, he turned green and was destructive and all that. Well, you know, I was pretty destructive when I drank. I mean, I did some pretty stupid stuff, but you know, that very thing in some ways has become a superpower for me.
How so?
It's been a way for me to help other people. It's been a way for me. Well, I will also say I recognize that drinking was just the way that I managed my distress. We all have distress, and we all find our own ways to manage our suffering. Alcohol was the way that I did it. And so when I, you know, encounter those people who've done the same thing, you know, I know how they feel. I can relate. I know how to talk to them. I know how to help them. And I know how to help them understand that it's not the alcohol.
It's not the alcohol. No,
it's not. It's that you're avoiding yourself.
That's right.
That's what it is. It's that I was avoiding myself.
You were avoiding your authentic self.
My authentic self. Yes.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back. Are you ready to transform and empower your life by changing the way you think, feel, and act? Then it's time to schedule a coaching call appointment with me, Ellen Stewart, Pushy Broad from the Bronx, certified empowerment coach and recovery coach. My style of coaching is part cheerleader and part drill sergeant, always in your corner and at the same time giving you the push you need to truly move forward and exactly what you need to take command of your life. If you are ready for the Pushy Broad from the Bronx, I am ready for you. Visit my website, pushybroadfromthebronx.com, and click on the link that says one-on-one coaching. Make an appointment today.
So now that we've come nicely and strongly to the other side, let's delve into the podcast. Just by doing the podcast, I think you're reinforcing your own path to authenticity. And talk to us a little bit about what your goals are going forward. I want to hear a little bit about what the podcast is like, what you do on the podcast, and where you're going in that direction.
Well, first I'll say that to actually start the podcast, it really is my own path to authenticity, because when it came time for me to do this, there was a job that I had that was coming to an end. It was a contractual position. And I had a decision to make. Am I going to take another full-time punching the clock sort of position in the interest of the illusion of security? And in doing so, delay again what I actually wanted to do. And it just seemed like this time, if I'm not going to do it now, when am I going to do it? So it was a risk. It was a difficult decision to make, but I made a decision not to go get a full-time job. So I started picking up enough contractual work, and I really delved into creative projects, including this podcast. So I'm, you know, I know there are people who listen to podcasts more than I do, but I have a couple favorites that I've listened to for more than a decade, semi-consistently, and they're long-form interview-type podcasts that have substantive conversations, real deep conversations. And I call the path to authenticity the opposite of small talk. I don't like small talk. I've never been the guy to stand around the water cooler and talk football. I like sports, but I would much rather have an hour-long deep dive conversation with Ellen Stewart than talk about who won on Sunday with 10 guys for 5 minutes. I just don't, it's not me. And it's part of what makes me a good counselor, because, you know, I'm a good listener. I like hearing people's stories. So it's really been a way for me to use a lot of my strengths together. So I've also always admired creative people. You know, the people who just exercise the courage to say, screw you, I'm going to go do what I want with my life. And if that means being a fine art photographer or an abstract expressionist painter pushy broad from the Bronx or a guitarist or whatever, you know, people who have that strength of character to just say, no, I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to carry out my vision. So initially it was about talking to those people and hearing their stories. So those of us like me who have had a harder time doing that would have a power of example, you know, would be able to hear what it's like to go through that process, what it's like to take those risks and really take a leap of faith, and also how satisfying it is. Because I will tell you, I am much happier having made that decision than I was before. I'm more attuned to who I am as a human being, and it feels good.
So the path to authenticity has truly been your own path to authenticity. It's really amazing how we learn by doing for ourselves. So in conclusion here, first of all, what haven't I asked you that I should?
Well, that's a loaded question, isn't it?
Yes,
what haven't you asked me that you should? Well, one of the things I'm also pretty passionate about, again, going back to just the idea of continual growth and continual personal improvement, one of the areas that I've worked on is, you know, who I am as a man and what it means to be a man and all that type of stuff. I've done a lot of reading. I sort of focus on that a lot with the guys that I work with. The writing that I'm doing is mostly focused on that because I think that especially now in history, things that we're hearing about, like toxic masculinity and male privilege and the Me Too movement. And, you know, there's so many things about manhood that are being questioned now, not to mention gender identity. I feel like we're really at a place where we need to rethink our understanding of manhood and maybe redefine it. And I it's important to me to, you know, I want to have a voice in that. And so that's part of what I'm working on.
So there's a book on the horizon.
There's a book on the horizon, and really the podcast initially was a, you know, I wanted to build a platform and a community for my writing. And I actually just started doing once a month a series of episodes called Getting Real About Manhood, where I have another guy who co-hosts it with me. You know, we talk to authors who've written books about manhood and just, you know, our understanding of it and maybe what some of the problems are with it and maybe what some of the solutions are, just to begin a dialogue. Because if we don't talk about this, nothing's ever going to change.
Well, this certainly is a topic that certainly comes to mind today. Not only do we have many podcasts and, you know, the Pushy Broad from the Bronx talks about the fact that everybody needs a little push, and we talk about empowerment and certainly not only from the male point of view, but specifically from the female point of view. And like you said, with the Me Too movement and empowering women, but it's really important to reiterate and give men a different voice so that the world can see men and manhood in a totally different light. And I think redefining that is something that only very brave men can do. So I applaud you for doing that.
Thank you. Thank you.
So tell our listeners, please, where they can find your podcast and where else they can find The Path to Authenticity.
Well, you can go to thepathtoauthenticity.com and find links to all the major platforms where you can listen. It's on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, you know, all the major platforms, Google Podcasts. Love to hear from you. thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. You know, you can find out more about me if you'd like at tomgentry.net. What else? What am I leaving out, Ellen?
You can find Tom at The Path to Authenticity on Instagram, and there is also a Facebook, Path to Authenticity. And I think, are you coming up with a YouTube channel, Tom?
I do have a YouTube channel. Yeah, The Path to Authenticity. And, you know, I've had some great authors on the podcast. I've had writers and artists and painters and therapists and coaches like Ellen. And I've done 70 episodes so far, working on number 71 after we get off the phone here. And you know, I want to reiterate, for me, a lot of this is about building a community. So if you're someone who wants a better life and wants to be more true to him or herself, reach out, listen. I'd love to engage. If you have ideas of who you'd like me to talk to, I want to hear about it.
Tom, thank you very much. That sounds like a great closing message. I really appreciate you. I know you forever. I love you.
Please listen to Tom Gentry's podcast, The Path to Authenticity. Thanks, Tom. I really enjoyed it. What does it truly mean to be authentic? Well, according to Webster's, authentic means from the source or origin. In fact, being authentic in a spiritual sense means as expressly directed from the source, through the soul. It is the raw, naked, unhindered expression of beingness of the soul. Being authentic is being genuine, is being true not only to the world and how the world sees you, but true to yourself. Understanding your liabilities and your assets. For me, it's understanding that the pushy broad from the Bronx is proud of who she is, meaning proud of who I am and what I want from life. Being authentic is having realistic perceptions of reality, accepting of ourselves and of other people. Being authentic is being kind and thoughtful, and having a non-hostile sense of humor. Being authentic is also able to express emotions freely and clearly. Being authentic is being willing to be open and learning from my mistakes. Being authentic is understanding my motivations for doing things. Being authentic is not being deceptive or unrealistic. Being authentic is not always looking to others for approval, but understanding that my approval has to come from me directly. Living an authentic life is to dispel what is false and eliminate the imitation of reality. Living an authentic life is understanding that I can be the person I truly want to be and not the person I think the world wants me to be. Living an authentic life is letting everybody see me for exactly who I am and not caring whether or not they'll accept me for it. Being authentic is what it means to be true to oneself. I truly hope that you are taking that journey towards the path to authenticity, just like my special guest, Tom Gentry, and begin your own process of self-discovery. This is Ellen Stewart, the pushy broad from the Bronx, saying thanks for listening, and remember, everybody needs a little push.
From the pushy broad from the Bronx, New York.
Here is disclaimer information that we are required to produce.
Professional coaches provide an ongoing partnership designed to help clients produce fulfilling results in their personal and professional lives. Coaches help people improve their performances and enhance the quality of their lives. Coaching services received from certified life coach Ellen Stewart, the pushy broad from the Bronx, are not offered as a substitute for professional mental health care or medical care, and are not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any mental health or medical conditions. The pushy broad from the Bronx is not acting as a mental health counselor or a medical professional. All comments and ideas offered by Ellen Stewart, the pushy broad from the Bronx, are solely for the purpose of aiding her audience in achieving their goals and hopefully keep you smiling in the process.